So, all right, I'm going to dive right in. Thank you for that, Chris. In talking about these two path factors of livelihood and action. But first, let me just see if I can zoom out and give you a little bit of the 40,000 foot view. And that is that when we look at the Buddhist teachings, it doesn't take too long before we recognize that the suggestion, if you will, usually we get caught in the Four Noble Truths, which is a whole nother talk. But really what the Buddha is asking us to do is to cultivate, this is the word cultivate, this path, this process, really a lifestyle that supports human flourishing. That's the game. And this path that we're trying to develop, eight's a big number. There are three core trainings that we develop. And at first, and like we just did now, we want to train the mind. Through meditation practices, through the cultivation of awareness, cultivation of concentration, cultivation of the heart. That's the part of it in America most people think of. They think of Buddhism, they think of meditation, and that's usually about as far as they get. And we also train in ethics, for lack of a better word, and that is to live a life of harmlessness, a life of integrity. A life that recognizes a shared humanity, which is probably the hardest part of the path, and the path that American Buddhism has not done a great job of acknowledging. And also training in wisdom, which is the one thing that everybody wants to get. And wisdom is this kind of tricky word that nobody actually knows what the hell it means. But I'll tell you what the bad setup is. Is wisdom, we come into Dharma practice and we think that there's something that we don't know. And if we could just know what that thing was, if we had this thing called wisdom, then on the other side of that experience, everything would make sense and everything would be easy and we would understand the whatever the Buddhist message of enlightenment is. And I can tell you that is certainly not the case. So if you're thinking along those lines, you might want to just get out of that because that's part of the big problem. Wisdom, ironically, is a result of cultivating the mind and developing integrity. So in the traditional sense, it's sila, samadhi, panya. It's integrity is the first training. Meditation is the second training. And as we develop those trainings, we start to experience wisdom. We start to have a more intuitive sense of how to navigate the world. And two of the path factors that are associated with ethics are right livelihood and right action and also right speech. And I'm going to politely put right speech aside because I want to talk about action and livelihood. So, and I'm going to actually say that action and livelihood are not the correct terms to be using, I don't believe. So I also believe, and when you look into the early canon, and I said this earlier, I think there are two paths. And I think that there's a monastic path, which has been well preserved, well documented. You can learn plenty about that. And then there's the path of the lay person. And I want to read this, comes from the Buddha himself. I forget where it comes from, but he says, there are not only 100 or 500, but far more men and women lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carry out my instructions, respond to my advice, have gone beyond doubt, and have become free from confusion. And have gained skill and have become independent of others in my teaching. And that comes from the early canon. So there were people like us who were doing this way back then. That got lost for 2,000 some odd years. And now it's kind of reemerging. You could say it's reemerging right now because there's, 30 some odd people here interested in this topic. And so the monastic path is generally a path of trying to eradicate suffering once and for all, adherence to strict 227 precepts, no sex, eating at very strict times, not dealing with money, really, really dedicating themselves to the life of Dharma, to the life of awakening. And my view has changed. I'm sure there's many of these monks who over the years who have actually achieved this enlightenment, this awakening, this full liberation. I don't think that's going to happen for me. I have kids. I have a mortgage. I'm a busy guy. At best, I meditate 45 minutes a day. I don't think that's going to be the case for me. So the other path is not so much the path of trying to end suffering, but the path of trying to flourish as a human, trying to have a life that is meaningful, a life that is happy, a life that engages in sensuality, that engages in the hedonic realm of the world and food and sexuality and entertainment and all of the pleasures of the world. And it's about trying to flourish. Also in a sense of liberation, which is a word that, so there's lots of words, there's awakening, enlightenment, liberation. They're all basically saying the same thing. Buddhist liberation is this term vimutti, which means liberation, freedom from greed, hatred, and confusion. And there's panya vimutti, which is liberation through wisdom, which is really kind of the way the monastic tradition has preserved it. And we've adopted that. And I think this is the problem. We think we're going to know something. So we get caught in epistemology. We get caught in, we thought, you know, if we were just clever or smart enough, or we just had all the right answers, that would somehow translate into being happy. And I'm sure many of you have realized that doesn't work so good. And then there's also citta vimutti, which I think is the path of the layperson, which is liberation through the heart, which is liberation through Brahma Viharas, which is liberation to a constructive, meaningful relationship to the world that we actually live in, which is the world of, you know, post-pandemic, polarized, racist society that we live in, you know? And so the conditions that we're trying to navigate are really challenging. So we come into these terms, so we look at right livelihood, which is the traditional way of speaking about it. So first of all, I think one of the things that's problematic in language is this word sama, which is at the beginning of every path factor, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, is already, by calling it right, now we're already in the terrible business of trying to do this practice right. And so the word sama is a very complex term. It much more means something like complete. It's actually really hard to translate. But it's skillful, it's complete. You know, I'll talk more about it, because it's unfortunately, like a lot of the important words in Buddhist practice, they're really hard to translate into English. But the thing that's most interesting is the word for action. Now, the word for action in Pali is a word that you all know, kama or karma, right? We all know this word, karma. Kama, karma is the translation for action. But if you look at the Pali and you look at the teachings, if you look at any of the books on Buddhism, it doesn't say sama kama, it says sama kamanta. What is this word kamanta? It always bothered, it always confused me. Like, what is kamanta? It's not, kama's action. Kamanta means something more like actually work. It means more like labor, more like business, more like how do we navigate the world? It's actually related to artisanship, as a craftsperson, as the farmer irrigating the field, the fletcher fashioning an arrow, the woodworker carving the wood. It's more in our how we are able to navigate the world through skillful, trained behaviors and actions. So that sounds a lot different to me than action. That's a way more complex and very much more rich idea. So, and then if we look at livelihood, which is typically sama ajiva, right livelihood, ajiva actually literally means for life, for living. What do we do to sustain life, which is not livelihood so much to me, it's actually survival. How do you survive? How do we make money? How do we, none of us have a monastery. You don't go out every day and beg for alms and get food and have a monastery. We don't have any of that. You have to take care of yourself. You have to, you know, have health insurance and pay a mortgage or pay rent. And a lot of times we end up having to do things that we don't really like, that we wouldn't choose to do, but we have to do. And so I think what happens is we get these two mixed up. And one of the things that's really, I think, challenging for many of us is that this is where we feel out of whack in our practice. We don't feel integrated, because how do we take our practice to the rest of our life? And most of us think that what we do for survival is our work. And then we operate under this assumption that we are our jobs. I am what I do to survive. And if you go to a cookout or a barbecue, or you go to any social event, how long does it take you before somebody asks you what you do? Top three questions? For sure. And then that means something about you. Oh, you do that. Okay, that must mean that you're like this. Right? You familiar with this? And the thing that's so tragic is what we're doing is we're dismissing all of the kind of ways in which we are doing our work. And so Dharma work entails a lot of work, the work of flourishing, the work of having to deal with the reality of the conditions, the reality of the pressures, the stress of not having enough, of confusion, of fear of not being able to survive, not having enough of money, not having enough of food, not having health insurance, not having all these things that all of us really have to deal with. And the bad setup that we're in is we find ourselves needing these things, and then we have to go out there and we have to do something so that we can survive. And if we think that what we do to survive is a reflection of our value or our worth, is our actually true work, then we don't actually get to do much of the real work that we really value. Like, I have a lot of friends, I think actually Prescott, you might be one of them, who spent a lot of time playing music. And they never made a career. I'm a musician, I'm sort of a failed musician. I don't play music anymore. I wanted to have a music career, I never did. But for me, that's been part of my work. I don't get a paycheck for it. I don't get a, it doesn't pay my mortgage, but it's been part of my work in life. Being in therapy has been part of my work. Being in 12-step recovery has been part of my work. I do all kinds of work all of the time that has nothing to do with what I do to survive. And I think that we would be best suited if we actually started to think about what is actually my work? What is my purpose? And in existential philosophy, they would call it the raison d'etre. And Albert Camus, kind of, what is my reason to be? Why am I here? And a lot of times we find, and I have a lot of musician and artist friends, a lot of times we feel passionate about music or art or poetry or hiking or whatever it is you feel passionate about. We think of that that gets put in the hobby category, the sort of derogatory hobby category, when actually it's much more part of our work. And a lot of us, many of us, never get the luxury of allowing our work to actually also be our survival, which I think in many ways is sort of the goal. I would love so much for the things that I'm passionate about, that I enjoy doing, the work that I enjoy doing, to also be what I do to survive, what I do to make money. And that's a really hard, and people have done it, people do it, but that's a really... I think to take that on as a Dharma practice is a beautiful and important thing. And to think that that's something different than what we're doing in Dharma practice is, I think, a really bad setup. And I've been the victim of this bad setup. So I'm really speaking much from that place than from somebody who sort of figured it out, because I certainly have not figured it out. And so I think that we can. So when I think of Buddhism, I don't have much interest in that term, frankly. To me, the Buddhism is a belief system, and I've kind of learned my lesson with belief systems. Dharma practice is, I feel like I've been practicing the Dharma, but now I actually feel like I'm really coming into the point where I'm doing Dharma work. And the reality is there's nothing on the other side of the wall of Dharma anyway. To some degree, Dharma just means everything. So can I take this quality of presence and ease and all these qualities I cultivate in my practice, can I actually bring those to literally everything that I do? And acknowledging that a lot of the stuff that I have to do, I don't want to do. But you know what? I like to pay the mortgage, and I like to buy shit for my kids, and I like to have food on the table. And that's part of the sacrifice that we're dealing with here. That's part of the dukkha. That's the very first noble truth task to take on. But what happens to people over the years is the music endeavor gets chucked to the side, the painting you wanted to finish sits in the garage, that retreat you wanted to get on doesn't get, we kind of abandon our work. And sometimes we feel like we have to, or we make reasons, we get burned out, we come up with these excuses and these rationalizations why we do that. And I think we have to be very careful that we don't do that. Because then everything just becomes about survival. And then life becomes this thing that I just fucking need to get through. And then we kind of experience this inner death, which is the word for Mara. Some of you know this term, Mara in Buddhism, which translates as the one who creates limits. The hindrances, we live by the hindrances. We are dictated by craving and aversion, restlessness, apathy, lethargy, and doubt. And we kind of give in to these destructive aspects of our humanity. You know, it was Benjamin Franklin I read recently said, and he said this way back, is that most people die at 21, but they don't bury the body till you're 80. And that kind of made the hair on the back of my neck stand up when I read that. I was like, man, that is true. And so we experience these, and a lot of it, and of course we live in a world and a culture that sets us up for this. You know, I recently heard a story on NPR called The 25th Hour about how corporate America is trying to figure out how can we get that 25th hour out of our employees. And to me, it's no surprise that people are quitting their jobs in record numbers. This last month, May, there were more people quit their jobs in the month of May than any other time in human American history. People are like, fuck this. I'm working for $12 an hour at Chipotle. And I think that as a culture, I think there's a little bit of a waking up to the fact that many of us have had to abandon the things that were so important to us or meaningful to us or things that we really enjoyed doing because we couldn't make money out of it. And I don't think you'll ever get to the end of having to negotiate that experience. You're never going to finish that. I think that's part of the work. And I think if you're with me here, I know this is probably not what you've heard before on these teachings, and to some degree it's probably fairly heretical, but I think it's also very accurate what I'm saying. I think what I'm saying is in the historic texts. It's in there. The people were doing this at the time of the Buddha. It just got lost. And I think it's reemerging right now. But I think that it behooves us to really take on, you know, there's also varying degrees of people. Some people just want to do some mindfulness for stress reduction. And, you know, I don't know y'all. I don't know how far down the rabbit hole you're all trying to go. I've just gone way too far down now that there's no turning back. I've taken the proverbial red pill or the blue pill or whichever pill you take in the matrix that, you know, makes you wake up to it all. And I think it's okay. It's totally appropriate how far down the rabbit hole that we want to go. But, sometimes I think it's important to us all to reflect on why are you doing this in the first place? And I think part of wisdom is actually having an accurate and a realistic expectation about what you actually think you're going to get out of doing this. Why did you take an hour and a half out of your busy schedule to be on the screen tonight? Why do you carve out 20 or 30 minutes a day to sit quietly and follow your breath? Is it to just be a Buddhist? Maybe that's okay. I've done that. I didn't find that to be all that rewarding. But part of it is being up for the challenge of like I'm dedicated to cultivating the best version of my life that I can for myself in this life based on the conditions that I'm in. And I'm willing to take the risks that it's going to take to do that. I'm willing to make the sacrifices it's going to take to do that. And I'm actually willing, you know, I was part of an organization which is sadly gone now, Against the Stream. I'm willing to actually reject a lot of the prevailing social norms and a lot of the ways in which society has set me up to fail. You know, I'm a big fan of Albert Camus, if you haven't figured that out yet, but he has this quote that I love. He says, "The only way to deal with an unfree world is to be so completely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion." And I think that I feel encouraged by that. I feel inspired by that kind of thinking. You know, this kind of against the stream, this, you know, understanding that the stream of the world, the stream of status quo, is not a stream that I want to put my inner tube in and float down, actually. You know, I'm actually interested in getting in the filth and turning the other way and trying to walk up the stream. Because to some degree, I have to. What's the alternative? The alternative, I guess I could just play by the rules of just trying to get what I want and try to avoid what I don't want and just hope that that pans out. You know? And maybe it does for some people. You know, I don't know. I'm not, you know, I don't think that this is for everybody. But I think that we find when we hit that, I think there's a lot of wisdom in being dissatisfied. A lot of wisdom in being dissatisfied. And so I think that from that place, we either collapse below that dissatisfaction, and we put the paintings away in the garage, and we stop writing the poetry, and we stop working on that book, or we stop riding that bike, or fixing that old car, or playing that guitar, or whatever it is for you, because we collapse below that level of dissatisfaction. And we sort of experience a kind of inner death. And, you know, and I think a lot of times there's this quote, I see if I can find it, that comes from Bhikkhu Bodhi that I read at almost every retreat. And I was super excited about this because I had a new student that I work with in my mentoring program who actually wanted to read me this paragraph the other day. And I said, dude, I read that paragraph at every retreat. And it's the beginning of Bhikkhu Bodhi's Eightfold Path. And he says this: the search for a spiritual path is born out of suffering. It does not start with lights and ecstasy, but with the hard tax of pain, disappointment, and confusion. However, for suffering to give birth to a genuine spiritual search, it must amount more than something passively received from without. It has to trigger an inner realization, a perception which pierces through the facile complacency of our usual encounter with the world to glimpse the uncertainty perpetually gaping underfoot. When this insight dawns, even if momentarily, it can precipitate a profound personal crisis. It overturns accustomed goals and values, mocks our routine preoccupations, and leaves old enjoyments stubbornly unsatisfied. At first, such challenges and changes are generally not welcome. We try to deny our vision and to try to smother our doubts. We struggle to drive away the discontent with new pursuits, but the flame of inquiry once lit continues to burn, and if we do not let ourselves be swept away by superficial readjustments or slouch back into a patched up version of our natural optimism, eventually this original glimmering of insight will flare up again. And at just this point, with all roadblocks, we are ready to seek a new way and bring this disquietude to an end. That's like the first paragraph in the book, Bhikkhu Bodhi's Eightfold Path. If you're not familiar with it, it's one of the few and only books on the Eightfold Path. And so I think that, as I mentioned at the beginning, I find that I have been very, I guess, unsatisfied with the teachings that I've had on right speech, right action, and right livelihood. I've found them to be very wanting. And I found that I've had to go back and try to rethink about this stuff and refigure this stuff, because truth be told, these ideas have been the very, very struggle of my entire life. It's what's challenged me the most, trying to deal with, you know, surviving in this world, but also simultaneously doing the meaningful work. And I think that's the issue here, and the part that's so challenging is we probably find we have to do these things simultaneously. Unless you have a big fat trust fund, which I do not have, a lot of times we find that we have to continue to do things for survival. And we have to continue to do our work. And we probably, most of us, will find that we have to do those simultaneously. So it's in our best interest to be very clear about which is which. this is just what I'm doing to survive, and it's okay, and I have to do it, and it needs to be done. And I also have to keep an eye on what is my work here. And taking that on, saying yes to that challenge, to say, okay, I understand that this is what this is the hand that I have to play, and I'm going to take that on as best as I can. And before we go into some Q&A, we're going to, I always get time screwed up. We got another half an hour, right, Chris? We're going to 8, is that correct? Okay. It's just to back into what comes before these. I want to say a few words about right speech. Now, also, too, it almost makes me cringe to say right speech, right action, right livelihood. I'm awaiting. Here comes the list of Buddhist rules on how I'm supposed to behave. They kind of reek of that, don't they? But we're stuck with them, and we're just going to have to play ball. But I think when we look back into speech, I think what helps us actually navigate this work and this survival is actually not adhering to the Buddhist list of how one should talk, but actually more about finding one's voice. And sama vacha, vacha, the Pali word vacha, actually literally means like voice. And so to me, the word voice in an English sense, you know, if you take a creative writing class, right, you know, one of the first things the teacher is going to say to you is to try to find your voice. Songwriters try to find their voice, both figuratively and literally, like trying to actually find their voice. But how do we express ourselves through the words that we choose to use? Now, if you think about a practice around voice as a Dharma practice, rather than adhering to the list of how one should speak from the kind of list of Buddhist rules, you'll find yourself in a much different kind of space. And I really encourage us all to try to see the sila path factors here, speech, finding our voice, finding our work in the midst of having to survive. That's a much richer and meaningful territory than you might have initially thought that it was. Because you don't live in a monastery. Your food is not taken care of. The pillow that you put your head on every night is well paid for by your labor. We live in a much different set of conditions. And so, the most challenging areas of my life are trying to find my voice and trying to communicate in a meaningful way with other people, trying to continue and be willing to do the hard work that is required so that I can flourish and that I can make something of this life that I can feel good about, in the midst of also having to do things I probably don't really want to do, because I actually would like to eat, and I would actually like to sleep in a comfortable bed, and I would like to drive a car that maybe won't break down the next time I get in it, as I'm sure you also all feel that way. And so that this is really, I think, when we're doing Dharma work, Dharma practice, this is mostly what we're doing. This is the majority of the labor. This is the elbow grease of the world that we navigate. We don't have the luxury, or the however you want to see it, of having being sustained by a monastic community. I mean, we all could do it. All of us could be accepted tomorrow, but most of us, I suspect, are not probably going to go down that road. And I think that's a beautiful road to go down. I have a lot of friends who have been monks. I have some people that I know now I'm so grateful for the Buddhist monastic tradition, for sure. Totally grateful. And I hope it continues. And I think we wouldn't be talking right now if it wasn't for that. But for those of us who aren't doing that, we need to be a little bit more sophisticated and a little bit more willing to see our practice in a different light. And trying to understand that Dharma is actually a lifestyle. To truly live Dharma is to embrace a lifestyle that is based in the ideas of liberation, that is based in the idea of willing to do some work, you know, and really based in this idea that you really just, you know, you can't really give up no matter what, because then what? And so I think and the word encouragement or enthusiasm, I think actually when I think of the teachings of right effort, which actually comes right after right livelihood, I sometimes think of the word effort as not necessarily effort, but enthusiasm. And can you muster any enthusiasm for all of this where you feel you can see the possibilities? You can see what the Buddha saw and what he's encouraging us to see, that the beautiful message that you can do this. This is totally doable. This is not some mystical, spooky, weird thing here. This is totally doable. And the Buddha said oftentimes in the suttas, if it were not possible, I would not ask you to try. And when you go to Myanmar, if you go to Burma, and you sit with the lineage that I'm most associated with, the lineage of Sayadaw Upandita and Mahasi Sayadaw, is that one of the encouragements that they give you is please keep trying. You know, one of our friends, Chris's friends, Andrew Chapman, was over there, and he was telling me this story about how he'd been meditating for like 10 hours and wanted to miss the last sit, and kind of was walking back to his kuti to get some sleep, and like three monks came over and totally were like, not busting him, but they're like, please keep trying. Please try. Because they're so over there. They're so like, you could totally do this. The level of enthusiasm is intoxicating. And I think we all could use a little bit of that over here. Because sometimes Dharma practice can turn into kind of like a chore.
Oh man, I gotta meditate and I gotta not say bad words and I gotta like work for a nonprofit agency and I gotta like, oh man. You know, it kind of gets like that pretty quick. I guess pretty grim Vipassana like, you know, so we don't want to do that either.
So I'm gonna pause here or pause or stop talking. I want to thank you for your kind attention this evening. And of course, what I'm most interested in is any questions or comments or disagreements or anything that has been stirred up or you want to ask or say about this conversation here this evening. So thank you. You can just come on screen and we'll see what we come up with. Thank you.